from Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Joe Palca reporting. It was external factors, says a Russian official. An airline official says only external factors could have caused the disintegration of a Russian passenger jet that crashed in Egypt. Alexander Smirnov, the director of flights for Metrojet Airlines, said today in Moscow that there are no technical failures that could lead to the plane breaking up in the air. According to Mr. Smirnov, the plane wasn't flying, it was falling. The crew had already lost control, and for that reason, there wasn't an attempt to get in contact and report on the accident as the accident was occurring. Mr. Smirnov said while ruling out technical and human error as the cause of the crash, he also stressed the importance of waiting for the findings of the investigation into the crash. South Korean President Park Geun-hye and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe have agreed to quickly resolve a decades-long dispute over Korean women forced to serve as sex slaves during Japan's brutal occupation of the Korean Peninsula in the first half of the 20th century. Now, the two leaders today made the promise during a bilateral summit in Seoul. This was their first since Mr. Abe took office in 2012 and Mr. Park taking office in 2013. The UN Security Council condemned the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab's attack Sunday on a Mogadishu hotel that left at least 12 people dead. The council praised the response by Somalia's army, which killed all of the attackers and highlighted terrorism in all its forms and manifestations as one of the most serious threats to global peace. Al-Shabaab seeks to impose a strict form of Islamic law on the country. This is VOA News. The surprising victory of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's AKP party in Sunday's general election has ended months of political uncertainty. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Supporters of the AKP party celebrated into the early hours of the morning on the streets of Istanbul. Speaking Sunday, Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu gave a unifying message. He said, let's roll up our sleeves and create a new Turkey in which politics is normalized, in which people greet one another peacefully. The shock victory, which confounded all of the country's opinion polls, was welcomed by the financial markets, with the Turkish lira surging in value as news broke about the result, which ended months of political uncertainty after June's inconclusive election. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Now, the Turkish lira was up sharply today, analyzing the election's possible impact on the economy in Turkey is Selva Demirel. She's an associate professor of economics at Koç University in Turkey.
So there's a temporary optimism. Like today, we see the stock market and the lira strengthening quite a bit. But I think this is temporary. It is important to know that this is temporary because if you think about it, we had a single-party government up until June anyway. So things that change after June, the uncertainty, yes, now is going to be back to single-party government. But I think in the long run, what is really important is the immediate risks that the Turkish economy will face and how the new government will design policies to face these risks.
For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told Kazakhstan President Nursultan Nazarbayev on Monday that the U.S. is appreciative of his support for nuclear nonproliferation and the fight against Islamic State insurgents.
Now, obviously, the future of Kazakhstan and of this region will be determined and should be determined by the people who live here, not by the United States or any other country.
The top U.S. diplomat stopped in the Kazakh capital as part of his four-day tour of former Soviet states in Central Asia. The White House says U.S. Special Operations troops sent to Syria will not be there to engage in raids or combat. White House Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes said at a Defense One summit that they are not going to be out fighting side by side with forces inside of Syria. Now, Mr. Rhodes said the troops are intended to be a force multiplier that will allow for those on the front lines of the fight against ISIL to better their efforts to take back territory. But he said the U.S. troops may have to engage the enemy. Last week, U.S. President Obama authorized up to 50 U.S. Special Operations troops to go to Syria. This is Joe Palca reporting in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yalke in Washington. Ahead, a member of an aviation consultancy firm speaks about the Russian plane crash in Egypt, reaction to a changing U.S. strategy in Syria. We get an update on the war on deadly Ebola.
I don't know if it's a win and lose situation. We're trying to keep up.
And hear about a nasty rumor about a pair of superstar singers. It's right here on The Voice of America. A Russian investigator said... A Russian investigator says Metrojet Airbus A321, which crashed more than 20 minutes after takeoff Saturday from Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt to St. Petersburg, broke up in midair after reaching about 9,400 meters in altitude. But Viktor Soroshenko of the Intergovernmental Aviation Committee cautioned it is too early to draw any conclusions. My colleague Victor Beatty is following all this and joins me here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. Will all 224 people on board Flight 9268, most of them Russian tourists, were killed in that early Saturday crash. Most of the bodies of the victims have now been returned to Russia. Debris is scattered over some 16 square kilometers of Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. All A321s in Metrojet's fleet have been grounded until the reason for the crash becomes clear. The two black box recorders, which contain vital flight data and cockpit voice recordings, are being examined by investigators. Islamic State-affiliated militants in Sinai have claimed responsibility for downing the aircraft. Scott Hamilton, editor of News and Comments of the Seattle-based aviation consultancy Liam Company, discussed with me what the Russian investigator might mean about the aircraft breaking apart in mid-flight.
There's either going to be a catastrophic structural failure or mechanical failure, or perhaps a bomb. It is very, very rare to have an airplane break up at cruise altitude. Now, it's also been reported that in 2001, it had major damage from a tail strike on takeoff or landing. I'm not sure which, in Cairo. So obviously investigators are going to pay close attention to that as well.
The plane apparently lost contact with air traffic control 23 minutes after takeoff. About what altitude might it be at that point?
I think the reports were that it was around 31,000 feet.
And is it possible that something fired from the ground could bring an aircraft down at that height?
Well, according to the news reports, the ISIS didn't have any missiles that could go above 20,000 feet or thereabouts. That still doesn't rule out the possibility of a bomb that was planted on the airplane. And obviously with this tail strike report, that's going to be a particular area of focus. But with the flight data and cockpit voice recorders recovered, there should be some indication really almost as soon as they have the investigators have a chance to analyze just what those tell you.
Does the fact that the debris is scattered a certain way suggest that it might be a bomb on board, and would there be residue on the aircraft fragments?
Well, there would be residue on the aircraft fragments. I certainly haven't seen enough information coming out of Egypt yet as to indicate how the debris was scattered. It was apparently scattered over a 7-mile area, which obviously does indicate an in-flight breakup. And according to the news reports, the tail section was found some distance from the main wreckage, which suggests that the tail section separated from the airplane. Again, was it something having to do with a structural issue? Was it something having to do with a bomb? We just don't know at this point.
When that Malaysian jetliner was downed over Ukraine, of course, it turned out to be a missile of some sort that was fired from the ground. Would there be any possible similarity between this incident and that one?
Well, certainly not if the missiles in ISIS control could not go above 20,000 feet and the plane was at 31,000 feet. That would suggest that there was something else at work here.
What do you make of several airliners, particularly Gulf carriers, who are avoiding the Sinai until the cause is determined?
I think that's just a prudence, given that it is a combat zone of sorts. They don't want to have a repeat of the Malaysian MH-17 shoot down over Ukraine.
Is airspace worldwide still fairly wide open, or does it become more restricted when you have incidents like this?
It becomes more restrictive when you're over combat zones, and there's a lot of restriction over the Middle East right now because of, obviously, all the combat that's going on there. Airspace is restricted over North Korea. You know, airlines aren't allowed to fly over North Korea, even though that's a more direct route, say, from Tokyo to Beijing. They have to go down and around South Korea to go into Beijing. So there are airspace restrictions, but anytime you have combat, there's additional restriction.
The A321 is a twin-engine, medium-hull aircraft that's been in service since 1994, with over 1,100 of the aircraft operating today worldwide.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Saturday's crash is still generating lots of attention on social media. Michael Lippin is here with more on that. Michael, what are the main tweet hashtags related to this crash?
Hi, Susan. Well, if you want to find tweets about the crash, I'd recommend searching for the hashtag 7K9268. That was the flight number of the crash plane, and it's the most widely used Twitter hashtag that I've seen so far. The Topsy Analytics website shows that 7K9268 has been mentioned in 23,000 tweets in the last 24 hours. Other hashtags that you can search for are hashtag A321. That's the model of the Airbus plane involved in the crash. You can also look for hashtag MetroJet, the English name of the airline, as well as its Russian name, hashtag Kogalymavia.
What have people been tweeting about those hashtags?
Well, in the last few hours, you can find a lot of images of the crash site in Sinai being posted, including, you know, aerial video and still photos taken from the ground. You've also got a lot of conflicting information about what may have brought down the plane, with the Russian airline saying one thing and Russian officials saying another. Susan?
Well, thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A group of Canadian researchers have developed a quick and inexpensive way to test for hepatitis B and male infertility. They say that their new paper-based DNA test could especially be helpful in diagnosing these unrelated but serious conditions in developing nations. Writing in the Journal of the American Chemical Society, the researchers say that within 10 minutes, their new test can detect an early-stage hepatitis B infection in a patient's blood serum. This is something that would give medical professionals valuable time to develop a proper treatment plan before the infection can spread. The same test can also be used to predict male fertility by checking the DNA integrity of sperm as precisely as current proven testing methods. The researchers say that their new diagnostic test can be made from materials that cost less than $1 per device. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Obama administration has announced for the first time it will deploy special forces in Syria to support local fighters battling Islamic State. The announcement prompted debate on the presidential campaign trail. Republican Senator Marco Rubio said Islamic State extremists must be confronted. But Rubio said he does not favor a massive U.S. military deployment to fight the Islamic State directly. Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders said he fears a deployment of up to 50 troops in Syria could be just the beginning of a larger commitment. Fellow Democrat Hillary Clinton's campaign issued a statement saying Clinton sees merit in a limited deployment to Syria, but opposes a larger ground war in the Middle East. The White House stressed a train and assist role for special forces sent to Syria, not a combat mission. International Edition's Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with David DeRoche, associate professor at the National Defense University, about the new U.S. strategy in Syria. Welcome, Mohammed. Critics are saying that sending special forces to Syria is a departure from President Obama's commitment not to put U.S. boots on the ground.
According to the military expert I talked to, boots on the ground refer to conventional ground combat operations. But a raid like the one that special forces helped Iraqi forces to free hostages is what the administration intends to use special forces to guide local fighters in Syria against the Islamic State group.
The administration is walking a very fine line. They don't want to have the sort of commitment in or the sort of presence in Syria that we have in Afghanistan and had in Iraq. But at the same time, they realize that the current the strategy we had been pursuing just isn't likely to produce the results we want. So I think though that there's not a huge difference of substance. It's not going to be an Afghan or an Iraq-like commitment. It's going to be something much, much smaller.
On the other hand, Syrian opposition leaders were disappointed that this strategy is a departure from U.S. assistance to the so-called moderate Syrian opposition that is focused on fighting President Assad.
Well, the U.S. train and equip program that failed was designed initially to prepare fighters to battle the Islamic State group and not Assad. However, the United States realized that for a more effective impact on the battlefield, the U.S. aid should go to fighters already battling ISIS on the ground, as Professor Durosh explains.
So I think there's a recognition that the United States is going to deal with, is going to arm some people that in the past we might have considered to be not desirable allies, you know, whether they're too extreme or, you know, that there was some sort of problem with them. And now we're somewhat lowering our standards in favor of more combat effectiveness. It's a recognition that the strategy we had been pursuing was not going to achieve our goals. And so we're going to perhaps sacrifice some of the standards we had been hoping for in favor of gaining increased combat effectiveness in Syria.
Professor Durosh said that the U.S. is still reluctant to establish a safe zone or pose a no-fly zone in Syria for a very good reason. Both options require a major military commitment, and with Russian military intervention in Syria, it becomes a more distant possibility.
Mohammed, what is the most likely scenario for a political transition in Syria following the expanded international conference in Vienna?
Well, according to Professor Durosh, the losses of Russia and Iran in Syria could define the most likely scenario there.
It really depends on how the parties see their position and what they see as their chances of achieving their goals. And I really don't know whether Iran thinks it can win and have a reinvigorated Bashar al-Assad regime controlling all of Syria, or whether Iran sees this as a quagmire and it's in their interests to come to a negotiated settlement that, you know, perhaps does not include Bashar al-Assad. If the latter is the case, then we stand a greater chance of a negotiated settlement. But the intervention of Russia and the ground intervention of Iran, which hasn't been as publicized, makes the achievement of the Syrian opposition's goals and the West's goals in Syria much less likely.
Thank you, Mohammed, for this analysis.
Thank you, Sue, for having me.
Coming up on International Edition, meet a foot soldier in the war against Ebola. And the rumor mill once again caused trouble in the music world. The World Health Organization reports 3 new confirmed cases of the disease Ebola in Guinea in the week ending October 18th. The WHO says since the beginning of the current Ebola outbreak, there have been a total of 28,476 reported cases in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, with 11,298 reported deaths to that date. Dr. John Dye is the chief of the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases Viral Immunology Branch, and he's been involved in the development of biovirus vaccines and therapeutics. And he joins us now on the line. Welcome, doctor.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
Excellent.
First of all, can you give us an update on the war against Ebola? Are you winning?
I don't know if it's a win and lose situation. We're trying to keep up. With this current outbreak in Western Africa, in 2 of the countries, they haven't had a reported case in at least a month, so that's a great sign. There are still cases in Guinea, and we're still battling, let's just put it that way.
Well, how are you approaching your research? What are you looking into?
So I work at the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, which is USAMRID, and that's a mouthful, I know. And for the last several decades, and myself for the last decade, we've been looking at developing vaccines and treatments for Ebola virus and other pathogens of interest that could potentially cause pandemics. So in the past 10 years, we've developed multiple vaccines that we have taken through small animal models and moved them into monkeys, seen protection, and now some of those vaccines that we've been developing at USAMRIID and testing are actually being assessed in Western Africa. So there are multiple vaccines that are currently in West Africa being implemented by Merck and Janssen to see if there is any efficacy. On top of that, we've also been trying to develop therapeutics, monoclonal antibodies, and drugs to actually combat the virus, which are currently being investigated as well. So there's a lot going on right now with the therapeutic and vaccine front with Ebola.
So for the layman, does that mean we're pretty close maybe to finding something to help here?
I think we are close. I think we have things in our cabinet that could be effective. The thing about this outbreak is, as you just mentioned, the number of people that were infected and the number of people that succumbed to the disease. Ebola has been around it's been around long before 1976, but we first learned about it in 1976. And prior to this outbreak of Ebola, there's only been about 20 outbreaks that have occurred. And we're talking about a total of 3,000 to 5,000 people that have been infected. So we haven't had a lot of people to look at to see if vaccines or treatments actually would be efficacious. So a silver lining, if you want to look at it that way, from this outbreak is we have a lot of people to look at. We have a large number of people that were infected and survived. So we actually have a way of trying to assess whether these vaccines or therapeutics work.
Well, thank you very much, Doctor, for taking your time to speak with us today. I appreciate it, and good luck with your work.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
Dr. John Dye is featured in the National Geographic show Breakthrough, which premiered on Sunday, November the 1st, and will be running for several weeks. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
A new book about hip-hop mogul Jay-Z and his wife Beyoncé, Becoming Beyoncé, The Untold Story, has been fueling the rumor mill with the tales of an alleged romance between Jay-Z and singer Rihanna. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about how the rumor got started and some of its consequences.
So this gentleman by the name of Jonathan Hay was hired by the producer of Rihanna's first single, Pawn the Replay, to do some work, some promotion work, essentially. And so after this book was released, and inside the book there was some speculation, or it implied that this rumor was made up by a publicist, this gentleman comes forward and says, well, actually, yeah, that's true. I made it up hoping that it would generate some publicity for the song. I just kind of threw it out there to see whether or not it would stick. And by golly, it stuck. So much so that Beyoncé and Jay-Z, and we did not know this at the time, but separated for a year back in 2005, as a result of this allegation.
Now, we should say that Rihanna's representatives, her legal team, and Veda Nobles, who wrote the Pawn the Replay, mm-hmm. said, I didn't hire this guy. He wasn't a publicist. He presented himself to me as something, but they're saying, Rihanna's people are saying, this guy was not officially representing her at all.
No, apparently the producer and the publicist had a couple of conversations, and sometimes this happens in the music industry. You meet someone at a party, they say, hey, I can help you. You say, okay, sure, let me know what you can do. And then they go do things to sort of prove that they have the juice, if you will, to make things happen. And so it sounds to me like that's what this is. And what makes the story even more interesting is that this guy now has an artist and he's promoting a couple of his own songs, which he's hoping to have released on Jay-Z's Tidal platform. So this is going to be really complicated for him if Jay-Z and or Beyonce decide to comment on this or decide to do something about it, which they have not.
Okay, now, still speaking of Jay-Z and Rihanna, Rihanna is reported to have inked a $25 million deal with Samsung. And Jay-Z's involved in that, too, is he not?
Right. Now, we may remember that Jay-Z had a huge deal with Samsung to release his Holy Grail album, Magna Carta Holy Grail album via their platform. Well, it sounds like, and we don't have all of the details now, but it sounds like Rihanna is going to do something very similar because Samsung has a new platform that's, I guess, kind of trying to compete with Apple Music, and it's called Milk Music, actually, and it's a radio service. So what I think may be happening here is Rihanna may have agreed to allow Samsung to release this new album that we've been waiting for forever and ever called Anti. And it would be a great thing for Samsung because, again, it's a highly anticipated album. And she wants to do something interesting for the release. So this would be it, I think.
All right. If you have any comments, you can send a tweet to Shauna at VOA Lady DJ. You can also log on to our website, voanews.com.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and visit our website at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On November 8th, the citizens of Burma will go to the polls. Over 6,000 candidates are vying for 1,171 parliamentary seats. It is the greatest test yet of the reforms launched by President Thein Sein and the ruling regime 4 years ago. Election campaigning began on September 8th, and for the first time in memory, no one knows who will win. That's a far cry from the last openly contested general election in 1990, when the opposition National League for Democracy won by a landslide, but the results were never recognized by the sitting government. Nonetheless, problems remain. First, in the words of Assistant Secretary for East Asian and Pacific Affairs Daniel Russell, we all recognize that the political playing field in Burma is not yet an even one. A number of obstacles are built into the system, preventing a truly democratic process. For example, the Burmese constitution reserves 25% of parliamentary seats and key cabinet posts for the military. Constitutional restrictions prevent the most prominent opposition politician, Aung San Suu Kyi, from running for president. And legislative restrictions and discrimination prevent some minority ethnic or religious groups from participating as candidates or voters. During a recent visit to Burma, Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes also raised concerns about religion being used as a tool of division during the election period. He noted to the press in Rangoon, "We see a risk of religious expression being inconsistent with a constitution that separates religion and politics. And of course, when that happens, ultimately it can pose a danger to religious minorities." These elections will be vitally important for the U.S. relationship with Burma. The conduct and results of these elections will fundamentally shape our engagement with the Burmese government in 2016 and beyond, said Assistant Secretary Russell. Our ability to assist the new Burmese government, let alone to look at relaxation of sanctions, will depend on our assessment of the integrity of the overall process. So far, the government of Burma has made a strong effort to improve the administration and transparency of the electoral process. To reinforce this effort, the United States is providing more than $18 million in assistance to conduct the elections. The 2015 elections are an important milestone in Burma's political transition away from dictatorship. But what will be even more critical is that the next government solidifies the political and social gains made and continues to push for additional reform, said Assistant Secretary Russell. The government and people of Burma have an opportunity in this election to demonstrate their commitment to building democratic institutions and processes. If the elections are credible, they can make a significant step forward.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. It's time to learn and improve your American English skills. Today we go back into the classroom with Jonathan Evans and Jill Robbins to talk about some very important parts of speech that you need to know. Then, after today's lesson, we will give you a chance to use what you have learned as we hear about tourism in Iran, as restrictions against the country are eased. So, let's get to work. Here is part one.
From VOA, Learning English, this is Everyday Grammar. In an earlier program, we talked about the relative pronouns who, that, and which. We promised to give you more details about how to use relative clauses. In this episode, we look at how the relative adverbs where, when, and why are used. Let's take a look at how relative adverbs work. An adverb is a word that describes a verb, an adjective, another adverb, or a sentence. It is often used to show time, manner and place, or degree. The relative pronouns where, when, and why act as adverbs when they join sentences or clauses. Take these two sentences.
This is a swimming pool. I used to swim in the pool.
Notice how you can put the sentences together with the word where. This is the pool where I used to swim.
Another way to say that is, this is the pool in which I used to swim. That is a formal way and usually only found in writing. We use the relative adverb where to show the place of an action. The relative adverb when tells about the time of an action. Let's look at an example from The Logical Song by the rock group Supertramp.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful. A miracle, oh, it was beautiful, magical. And then they showed me a
The singer says that life was wonderful when he was young. Later, he uses another adverb to show the world where he could be dependable. A more formal way to say that would be, they showed me a world in which I could be dependable.
We often want to tell the reason for an action. This week, President Obama visited Alaska and talked about melting ice. So much ice is melting in Alaska, he said, that sea levels are rising quickly. Here's how he put it.
The pace of melting is only getting faster.
It's now twice what it was between 1950 and 2000. Twice as fast as it was just a little over a decade ago. And it's one of the reasons why sea levels rose by about 8 inches over the last century. And why are they projected to rise another 1 to 4 feet this century?
President Obama made one sentence from these two ideas.
Ice is melting very quickly. Sea levels rose about 8 inches in the last 100 years.
His speech has another clause with a relative adverb that combines these ideas.
Ice is melting very quickly. Scientists predict that sea levels will rise even more.
The words the reason or the reasons often appear before the relative adverb why, but sometimes they are left out, as in President Obama's speech.
And why are they projected to rise another 1 to 4 feet this century?
Are you ready to try some sentences on your own? Put together these sentences with relative adverbs.
The coffee house is in my neighborhood. He got a job in a coffee house.
Is your answer like this? The coffee house where he got a job is in my neighborhood. Here's another one.
I got home from work. I saw the dogs playing in the yard.
One way to put these ideas together is, I saw the dogs playing in the yard when I got home from work.
Finally, let's put these two sentences together.
The dogs frightened the cat. The cat ran up the tree.
Combine these ideas as, the dogs are the reason why the cat ran up the tree.
You will sometimes hear that instead of why after the word reason, as in,
the dogs are the reason that the cat ran up the tree.
We leave you with Earth, Wind, and Fire singing Reasons.
Ooh, baby, I can't find the reasons why my love, it won't disappear. Can't find the reasons why I love you. Hey, I love you.
For Voice of America Learning English, Everyday Grammar, I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The United States and other countries plan to begin easing economic restrictions against Iran next year. The easing of sanctions is part of the deal between six world powers and Iran to limit its nuclear activities. Iranians hope that the end of travel restrictions will lead to more foreigners visiting the country. In London, travel agents say some people are already asking how they can visit Iran. Christopher Jones-Cruz reports.
Tour companies say very few non-Iranians have ever been to Iran. They describe the country as one of the unexplored jewels of the Middle East. They say the countryside is beautiful and its people friendly. Foreigners have stayed away from Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. In 2013, just 90,000 people from North America and European Union countries visited Iran. Mehrdad Konsari works at Iran's Organization for Economic Reconstruction and National Reconciliation.
The difficulties we've had in Iran has definitely hurt the tourist industry in the sense that people are afraid to go. But those people that ventured and, you know, overcame these considerations and visited Iran were never sorry.
The nuclear deal reached in July is already helping to ease travel restrictions. Johnny Bielby founded Wild Frontiers Travel, a British travel agency. He says the agreement has led to an increase in interest in Iran.
Two things have happened since the nuclear deal. First of all, the Foreign Office had changed their advice against travel to Iran, and that's made it much simpler for people to get insurance and that sort of thing. So the numbers have gone up again. We've had to put on three extra departures this year alone to cope with the demand for the autumn season to Iran.
British traveller Bugsy Heath-Brown is joining one of those tour groups.
We decided to get on one of the first trips that we could to get out there, see the sights, meet the people before the big rush of the rest of the world.
Iran says it hopes to have 20 million visitors a year by 2025. Mr. Kansari says those tourists could spend up to $30 billion.
Now that this outside face of Iran is beginning to change, that I think the tourism offers a great opportunity for the Iranian economy.
Tour operators in the West say getting permission from Iranian officials to enter the country is still difficult. Sanctions are still in place, limiting the ability of banks in Iran to operate outside the country. As a result, most payments have to be made in cash. I'm Christopher Jones-Cruz.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. Scientists in England are using two self-directed water vehicles to explore the animal and plant life of the Celtic Sea. The Celtic Sea is a body of water off the southern coast of Ireland. The area is known for its exceptional sea life. Scientists want to know why marine animals are so attracted to this part of the Atlantic Ocean. One of the research vehicles is powered by batteries. It collects information for the National Oceanographic Centre in Southampton, England, and the World Wildlife Fund. The vehicle's low energy requirements permit it to stay afloat for up to 30 days. Reports of what it finds in the Celtic Sea are sent by satellite. Stephen Woodward is an engineer who helped design the craft. He says the vehicle has equipment that can detect small organisms called zooplankton and fish. He adds that other sensing devices measure water currents and other features of sea life. The vehicle also creates a two-dimensional map of the sea. Another vehicle is powered by solar panels and a wind turbine. It can stay afloat for months. The robotic vehicle sends information about the so-called biodiversity hotspots. A biodiversity hotspot is an area of an ocean that has a lot of plant and animal life activity. Lavinia Suberg is one of the scientists studying the biodiversity of the Celtic Sea. She says productive ocean areas, like the Celtic Sea, attract zooplankton. The zooplankton then attract fish. She adds that areas with a large increase of fish often attract sea mammals and birds. Using these robotic ocean vehicles greatly reduces the cost of exploring the seas with manned laboratories. Scientists can spend more time analyzing the collected information. They say the research will give them a better understanding of the needs of the Celtic Sea for future management and protection. And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report.
For more technology stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
You can email comments to us at learningenglish@voanews.com. Give us a like on the VOA Learning English Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Learn English.
I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In October of 1859, a group of anti-slavery extremists attacked the town of Harper's Ferry. Harper's Ferry was part of Virginia then. Today, it is located in West Virginia. The attackers were led by John Brown. They seized a gun factory and a federal supply center where military equipment was kept. They planned to use the guns and equipment to organize a rebel army of slaves. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell us what happened to John Brown after he seized Harper's Ferry.
The President of the United States in 1859 was James Buchanan. When Buchanan learned of the attack, he wanted immediate action. He sent a force of Marines to Harper's Ferry under the command of Army Colonel Robert E. Lee. John Brown had attacked with about 20 men. Several, including two of his sons, had been killed by local militia. He and his remaining men withdrew to a small brick building. The attack had failed. Not one slave had come to Harper's Ferry to help Brown. The few whom his men had freed had refused to fight when the shooting started. Brown could not understand the fear that kept the slaves from fighting for their freedom.
Brown and his men were trapped inside the brick building. They held a few hostages whom they hoped to exchange for their freedom. Colonel Lee wrote a message to John Brown demanding his surrender. He did not think Brown would surrender peaceably, so he planned to attack as soon as Brown rejected the message. He felt this was the surest way to save the lives of the hostages. As expected, Brown refused to surrender. He said he and his men had the right to go free. As soon as Brown spoke, the signal was given. The Marines attacked. They broke open a small hole in the door of the brick building. One by one, the Marines moved through the hole. They fought hand to hand against the men inside. After a brief fight, they won. John Brown's rebellion was crushed.
A few hours after Brown was captured, the governor of Virginia and three congressmen arrived in Harper's Ferry. They wanted to question Brown. Brown had been wounded in the final attack. He was weak from the loss of blood, but he welcomed the chance to explain his actions. The officials first asked where Brown got the money to organize his raid. Brown said he raised most of it himself. He refused to give the names of any of his supporters. Then the officials asked why Brown had come to Harper's Ferry. "We came to free the slaves," Brown said. and only that. He continued, I think that you are guilty of a great wrong against God and humanity. I believe anyone would be perfectly right to interfere with you so far as to free those you wickedly hold in slavery. I think I did right. You had better, all you people of the South, prepare yourselves for a settlement sooner than you are prepared for it. You may get rid of me very easily. I am nearly gone now. But this question is still to be settled, this Negro question, I mean. That is not yet ended.
The raid on Harper's Ferry increased the bitterness of the national dispute over slavery. Members of the Democratic Party called the raid a plot by the Republican Party. Republican leaders denied the charge. They said the raid was the work of one man, one madman, John Brown. Still, they said, he had acted for good reason, to end slavery in America. Southern newspapers condemned Brown. Some said his raid was an act of war. Some demanded that he be executed as a thief and murderer. Many Southerners said all of the North was responsible for the raid. They believed all Northerners wanted a slave rebellion in the South. And it was such a rebellion that Southerners feared more than anything else. New measures were approved throughout the South to prevent this. Military law was declared in some areas. Slave owners threatened to beat or hang any Negro who even looked rebellious.
The fear of a slave rebellion united the people of the South. For years, rich slave owners had talked of taking the Southern states out of the Union to save their way of life. But those who had no slaves opposed the idea of disunion. John Brown's raid changed that. After his attack on Harper's Ferry, the South spoke with one voice. All Southerners declared that they would fight to protect their homes from a Negro rebellion or from another attack by men like Brown. Feelings were especially high in Virginia, the state in which the raid took place. Virginians wanted Brown punished quickly to show what would happen to anyone who tried to lead a Negro rebellion. There was some question whether Brown should be tried in a federal court or a state court. Brown's raid took place within the borders of a state, but the property he seized belonged to the federal government. The governor of Virginia decided to try Brown in a state court. He believed a federal court trial would take too long. If Brown were not brought to trial quickly, he said, people might attack the jail and kill him.
Brown was being held in Charlestown, a few kilometers from Harper's Ferry. The court there named two lawyers to defend him. a doctor examined Brown. He reported that Brown's wounds were not serious enough to prevent the trial from starting. Brown lay in a bed in the courtroom throughout the trial. John Brown's lawyers tried to show that his family had a history of madness. They tried to prove that Brown, too, was mad. They asked the court to declare him innocent because of insanity. Brown protested. He said the lawyers were just trying to save his life. He did not want such a defense. The matter of insanity was dropped.
Brown's lawyers then argued that he was not guilty of the three crimes with which he was charged. First, they said, he could not be guilty of treason against Virginia because he was not a citizen of Virginia. Second, he could not be guilty of plotting a slave rebellion because he had never incited slaves against their owners. And third, he could not be guilty of murder because he had killed only in self-defense. The trial lasted 5 days. The jury found John Brown guilty of all three charges.
The judge asked Brown if he wanted to make a statement before being sentenced. Brown did. He declared that he had not planned to start a slave rebellion. He said he only wanted to free some slaves and take them to Canada. Brown's statement was strong, but it was not true. He had, in fact, planned to organize an army of slaves to fight for their freedom. He acted in the belief that slaves throughout the South would rise up against their owners and join him. Brown's words did not move the judge. He said he could find no reason to question the jury's decision that Brown was guilty. He sentenced Brown to be hanged.
One of Brown's supporters attempted to find a way to free Brown from jail. Several plans were proposed. None were tried. Brown himself did not want to escape. He said he could do more to destroy slavery by hanging than by staying alive. John Brown was executed on December 2, 1859. His death created a wave of public emotion throughout the country. In the North, people mourned. One man wrote, "The events of the last month or two have done more to build Northern opposition to slavery than anything which has ever happened before, than all the anti-slavery pamphlets and books that have ever been written." In the South, people cheered, but their happiness at Brown's punishment was mixed with anger at those who honored him. As the nation prepared for a presidential election year, the South renewed its promise to defend slavery or leave the Union. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant. Transcripts of our programs can be found along with MP3s, podcasts, and historical images at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.